friends. This week we received a letter from a father who had received a report from school about his son. The father apparently was a doctor. The boy had good notes in everything except penmanship. And the father said to him, "You must learn to write. If you don't, you'll grow up to be a doctor like me." And the little boy said, "Or maybe like Bishop Sheen, he can't write either." We are, I discover, starting a new fashion and style. We have received a picture of a little boy in Minneapolis, which you will now see. This little boy, you see, is dressed just exactly as I am, even down to the yarmulke. I think that possibly Hopalong Cassidy better watch out for his loyals. His yarmulkes will be substituted for 10-gallon hats. And apropos of styles, I heard of a man the other day who went in and bought a hat from Madame Nicole. And it was, of course, the very latest style. And he dashed out of the shop madly and down the avenue. And someone said to him, "Why all the hurry?" He said, "I want to hurry home. I'm afraid it'll get out of style." Which is an introduction for a style in ideas. It's all right to have style in clothes. But today there's a certain amount of snobbery about time. And people feel that any idea that is modern is necessarily the best. The assumption is that inasmuch as there is progress in the world that is inevitable and necessary, then it follows that any idea which we have today is much better than the idea of last year or 10 years ago. Now, this snobbery of time as regards an idea is not necessarily justified. Time does not make us better. Time could conceivably make us much worse. For example, a white fence does not get whiter with time, it gets blacker. And then, too, very often what people call modern is nothing but an old error with a new label. Whenever you have an idea that you are absolutely sure is original and no one ever thought of it before, go back and see how the Greeks put it. They had it too. Then too, this idea that everything that is modern enough today is the very best is based upon the idea that if we move with the times, we are wise. It's well to remember that dead bodies float down streams. It is only live bodies that resist the current. And particularly, we find this snobbery of time in the present tendency to divide everyone into what is called a liberal or a reactionary, so that we all are asked whether we belong to the left or whether we belong to the right. Now, it is not necessary, really, to belong to either one, because these are extremes. Let me prove it to you. In everything that changes, there must always be something that is changeless. For example, you meet someone whom you haven't seen in 20 years, and you say, "My, how you've changed. How fat you got." Well, now, it may be true that this person is a victim of circumference, but how would you know that? How would you know there was a change unless there had been something changeless in the person? Or, for example, one woman meets another and she says, "I like you much better as a blonde than as a brunette." And then she invariably also adds, "And also those fine black roots." So there must always be change with the changeless. Now, as you see, the liberal takes the change and the reactionary emphasizes the changeless. Here are some examples of it. A liberal may be described, or rather a reactionary may be described, as a man with 2 feet, a pair of shoes, but he absolutely refuses to walk. A liberal has been very well described as one who has both feet firmly planted in midair. A reactionary has a boy. The boy wears a green hat at the age of 2. And the reactionary says, Johnny, you wear a green hat now, you'll wear it at 12, you'll wear it at 20, you'll wear it all your life. The liberal said, let's give Johnny a new head. Not a new hat, a new head. A reactionary is a flat tire on the wheels of progress. A liberal is the automobile without a steering gear. He doesn't know where he's going, but he's certainly on his way. The liberal emphasizes the pendulum of the clock without the clock, and the reactionary the clock without the pendulum. See, both are creations of time, related to it. Now, there also is a law about liberals and reactionaries, and the law is this. Every liberal is a reactionary. He's in reaction to the last form of liberalism. That isn't too difficult to understand. For example, a woman buys a new gown. It's the dernier cri, and it's even described as tearing and shocking. She goes to a ball. There's another ball the following week. Would she wear that same gown? She would die first. She is already in reaction to the last form of liberalism. Take, for example, our modern woman. What is the modern woman? From the liberal point of view, well, she's someone who drinks cocktails, smokes cigarettes, and wears red fingernails. As Dorothy Parker says, she looks as if she just gored an ox. Now, she is the liberal in womanhood, but she's in reaction to the last form of liberalism, which was the Victorian woman with a bustle and a high collar, and someone who kept in a notebook quotations from Lord Byron and loved the waltzes of Strauss. And that woman was in reaction to another form of liberalism, which was the Puritan who thought that a waltz was a kind of an orgy. And it's true also in politics. The old liberal of the 19th century, the liberal that was made by Adam Smith and James Stuart Mill, believed that there should be economic production without state control. The modern liberal is in reaction to the last form of liberalism, and the modern liberal believes there should be economic production with state control, even with a form of socialism. And thus you see, they are always juggling ideas from one end to the other, and everything is decided on the basis of time instead of on the basis of reason. And we decide arguments with slogans, carrying the burden of those who are too lazy to think for themselves, or emotions. People justify a position by saying, well, I feel it in here. What is needed really in our modern world that is so dedicated to time and is so forgotten reason and discussion and controversy and argument and intelligence? We need someone who will bring to the world, first of all, the use of reason. In other words, induce us once more to think. Secondly, our ideal will be one who, in discussion and in presentation of thought, will always give and know both sides of the question, and not one side only. And thirdly, he will always argue from the other person's position or premise. These are some of the ideals of intelligence to restore sanity to the world. And who can ever bring them back? I think I know someone who can. I'll tell you a bit about his life. When he was born, his father went out and told the neighbors, well, the little calf has come. Then he went to school. He was rather a big fellow, big arms, big legs, neck, body. Very timid. And the fellow students used to call him an ox. The dumb ox. And one day, his professor became angry at the students for calling this big boy a dumb ox. And his professor said, someday the bellowings of that ox will be heard around the world. He used reason so very cleverly that naturally he was led to God. And his parents and relatives tried to deflect him a bit from that position. They were rather modern. They thought the way to do it was to interest him in sex. So they introduced a woman into his room one day when he was studying. And he reached over to the fireplace and he picked up a blazing poker and he chased her out of the room, and then he traced upon the door of his room a blazing cross, and then sat down and thought. And how he thought. When was he born? 1224. His name? Thomas Aquinas. And though he lived to be about only 50, he wrote these 34 volumes. They're all in Latin. Some of them have been done into English. One of the greatest masterpieces of the human mind. I had to go through all of these when I was in the university in Louvain. As a matter of fact, we had to read every line of them. Took a whole year to do it, too. My angel brought these books out, incidentally. He's very humble. He doesn't mind carrying books out. I'm going to show you how he thought and how he reasoned. First of all, I said he used reason. He said you cannot begin with faith. There must be a reason for faith. And before you accept anything, there must be a motive for that belief. This was rather astounding to people who thought that you began religion, particularly supernatural religion, with faith without reason. Then he took up, for example, such a question as the existence of God. And he said, is the existence of God self-evident? And he said, no. It is not self-evident. You have to use your reason to prove it. And he began using his reason. And his first argument for the existence of God that he gave was the fact of evolution. He says there's evolution in the world. It was cosmic. He embraced everything, not only biological evolution. Even mental evolution in the sense of the evolution of thought within the human mind itself. So he gave reasons for everything. And in addition to that, he always gave both sides of a position. How rare that is. Let me give you an example of the structure of this work. Here, for example, is his question. Does God exist? I'm going to bring it up here to the camera. Is this the camera that can take care of it? He asks if God exists. Now, he begins always by giving the opposite position, and honestly and fairly. And his first argument is, no, God does not exist. He said, if God exists, he had to be perfect. If he's perfect, he's perfect goodness. If he's perfect goodness, there can be no evil in the world. But there is evil in the world, therefore God does not exist. Then he gives the second position. You do not need God. Nature explains everything. And after he has given the objection, the other man's point of view, then he gives his own position and answers the objections. And that is true. That is the case throughout his entire work. You cannot pick up, for example, a volume of Karl Marx and find any honest presentation for the case of private property, or for Christianity, or for the existence of God. You cannot pick up Lenin and find a presentation of another position than that of communism. But here, positions are presented so strongly and honestly, and in the words of their own protagonists. Let me tell you a story about Voltaire. You remember Voltaire was that scoffer who boasted that it took 12 men to found the infamy of Christianity, but he said, I will destroy it alone. Voltaire went to a convent, rather a monastery, a Benedictine monastery. He lived there about 6 months. And the news went around France. Voltaire is getting the gift of faith. Oh, no, he was not. You know what he was doing during those 6 months? He was copying out all the objections that there are in these books. And he never read the answers. That's Voltaire. That's why I like the tradition in which I've been educated. We've always been told the other man's point of view, and we're told to think it out. Now, for example, the question of Freud. Here's an article in which St. Thomas asks whether the happiness of man consists in sex. There it is. He gives 5 reasons why it does, and they're much better than Freud gives. And he answers them too. And then not only does he use his reason, not only does he give both sides, but he also maintains that you must argue from the other man's point of view and never from your own. In other words, when you're arguing with an atheist, you must never say, well, you're a dirty atheist, you do not believe in God. When you're arguing with a communist, it does no good to say you're a materialist. Thomas Aquinas says, always understand his point of view and start with it. Here is a beautiful example of how he did it. One of his friends, Raymond of Pinafort, had been a missionary among the Muslims. And he was unable to do very much with the Muslims. So Raymond of Pinafort came back and said to Thomas, will you write me a book? So Thomas wrote Contra Gentiles. And this is what he says. He said, when you're arguing with the Muslims, do not quote the Bible. They have their own Bible, which is the Quran. When you're arguing with a Jew, it's all right to use the Old Testament. Arguing Christianity, use the New Testament. But when you argue with Muslims, do not first bring them the Bible. First bring them reason. Think. This is common to both the Muslim and the Christian. This was his approach. And if we could only sell the country on the necessity of honest thinking, that is why we started this program, incidentally, to give the American people reasons for a position, not just to state a position. You know, the trouble with our world today is there's entirely too much authoritarianism in it. First of all, there's the authoritarianism of the totalitarian systems which impose an idea by force, and then there's this other authoritarianism of democratic countries in which people believe something without having any reasons given, and they even do not want reasons. And there are the skeptics who say, oh no, I cannot think, I do not know whether there is a God or not. Let's make them think. This reason that has been given to us is a reflection of the divine word. And it was not meant to rust in us unused. It is the noblest faculty that we possess. And these skeptics have a very false humility. And they tell us they cannot know and they cannot think out these problems. Why, if their position became universal, the world would die of skeptic poison. So we appeal to abandon prejudice, to summon up reason, which is the common bond of all men under God. We have not used it sufficiently. There's been a softening of our brains. And here we appeal for a hardening of brains, the development of this great tradition called thinkage. And perhaps if we have a hardening of brains, then we will have something that is good. We will have a softening of the heart, and God will bless us.
Mules, jackasses, worms, and centipedes have the choice only of going to the right or to the left. Man has the alternative of going up or down. May it be up. God love you.